The thesis that RNA was probably the primordial molecule is very compelling, because it had both functional and information carrying capacity. But there's no reason to think that those functions were ever lost. It does appear that in bacteria, RNA devolved its storage functions to DNA as a much more stable and easily replicable molecule, and its analog functions to proteins, which have much greater chemical versatility. So, based on that, the idea grew up that RNA had sort of descended to become simply an ephemeral intermediate between the hard disk, the storage, and the analog outputs, the proteins. But what we think has actually happened later in evolution, that RNA has re-entered the scene to fulfill a regulatory requirement, and has acquired a whole range of functions based on those same early properties of sequence specificity and the ability to fold into very complex shapes to interact with other molecules or have functions itself. There are a few key points. The first is that, and this is one of the great surprises of the genome projects, that very few people really have commented on, because they have background assumptions, but that both the number and range of protein coding genes has essentially remained largely the same since the base of the metazoan radiation. C. elegans, which is a worm of only 1,000 cells, has almost precisely the same number of protein coding genes as humans, about 20,000, which is the latest estimate. And most of those genes encode orthologous functions. So the part set for metazoan or animal development was established, 700 million years ago. In fact, I understand that the sponge genome has found much the same thing, 20,000 protein coding genes, most of which are orthologous, including most, if not all, of the key protein families that are involved in regulating development. Now, C. elegans has only got 1,000 cells, a few muscle cells, a few nerve cells in the gut. We humans have 30 to 100 trillion cells, and the complexity of the body plan organization, all the muscles in your face that create the range of human expressions, etc., the brain, enormous. Now, interestingly, that problem, I think, has been swept under the intellectual carpet because of the relatively facile and widely accepted, but not challenged, nor justified assumption that the combinatorics of transcription factors give you such a range of regulatory possibilities that there's enough in the system to do it, and that explains worm to human. But, you certainly need to have a more complex regulation to get to a more complex organism. So the astounding thing is, the only thing that does scale with complexity, because the numbers of genes does not, is the extent of the non-protein coding genome, the non-coding genome, junk. Now, of course, that's going to include regulatory elements, but it's so large in humans, 98.8%, that people had not considered that this could all be regulatory and that most of it must be just evolutionary debris, a view that was really compounded by the fact that roughly half our genome is derived from transposons, something we might come back to. In any case, protein coding genes do not scale with complexity. The non-coding genome does, to first approximation. And the interesting thing, which is really what attracted me to this in the first place, 30 years ago when introns were discovered, is that, surprisingly, all of these non-coding sequences, or virtually all of them, are transcribed into non-protein coding RNAs. And apparently, or evidently, I should say, in a differential fashion, that seems to be developmental specific, tissue specific, cell stage specific, etc. So you've only got two alternatives. And this is what occurred to me back in 1978 when I first bumped into introns as a postdoctoral fellow. Because, it was universally and immediately assumed, everybody, including Crick, that because these sequences did not code for protein, that they must be junk. And they were rationalized as the hangovers of early evolution. And I was a young postdoc in Houston at the time. And I remember thinking to myself, this is a very strange observation. This stuff is made, these huge genes are made into RNAs, and then the introns are cut out and apparently discarded, the RNA. And so it's one possibility is junk, and it's just useless recycling of ribonucleotides. But the other possibility is, and was then, that this stuff is functional. This is an old chestnut, the level of conservation. And in your question about the relative conservation is, in fact, embedded the answer. RNA, the non-coding RNAs that are differentially transcribed in a developmentally regulated manner from virtually the entire genome, are on the whole less conserved than protein-coding sequences. They're relatively less conserved. But lack of conservation does not mean, lack of relative conservation does not mean lack of function. Conservation is constrained or imposed, I should say, by structure-function relationships. And the structure-function relationships in most proteins are very strict. There's only so many ways to make an oxygen binding property, or a wheel for that matter. Analog structures have particular functional imperatives. But regulatory molecules can be much more plastic, just like your credit card. Doesn't mean they don't have important information. And indeed, I think most people, even those who may be skeptical about the level of importance of RNAs, would acknowledge that most of phenotypic radiation and evolutionary adaptation occurs in the regulatory sequence, which would take a relatively common set of components, and this is an important point I'll come back to, a relatively common set of components and arrange their expression in different ways to produce a range of phenotypic outcomes, both between species and within species. The lack of conservation of RNAs is not a lack of conservation, it's a lower relative conservation, it varies, and it reflects the greater plasticity of regulatory molecules and the fact that this is where evolution is selecting, initially positively, secondly negatively, for regulatory variation that underpins phenotypic radiation. It does seem that we've fundamentally misunderstood the structure of genetic programming of the higher organisms because of the assumption, which is largely true for bacteria but turning out not to be true for the complex eukaryotes, that most genetic information is transacted by proteins. There's a vast hidden layer of regulatory RNAs that are involved in directing the epigenetic trajectories of differentiation development. And this is just starting to be peeled back now. Perhaps the best way to answer the question is to give two examples of how these RNAs are functioning and why the system has moved to an RNA regulatory system away from a protein-based regulatory system, which people don't fully understand. The first is microRNAs. Now, microRNAs have been, you know, really discovered about a decade ago based on some terrific genetics in C. elegans in the preceding decade. And microRNAs are now known to regulate virtually all known developmental processes in animals and plants. MicroRNAs have no known catalytic function, just 22 or so nucleotides which recognize a target. And that complex, in some fashion that's not fully understood, is then recognized and acted upon by a generic protein complex called a RISC complex. So the cell, and indeed evolution, can dial up these microRNAs very flexibly in different cells and hit a target, and they only need one big fat protein complex to come and do the job. So they've separated the signal from the consequent analog action, which instead of having one big RISC complex for every regulatory event they want to do, they can now compact that into a single generic complex and use flexible, much more genomically compact and evolutionarily flexible small RNAs to recruit these complexes. It's not as well accepted yet, but it's looking increasingly like the same thing is occurring in chromatin modification and epigenetic control, which is the critical underpinning of differentiation development. Nobody would dispute that modulation of chromatin structure and epigenetic memory is critical to development of complex organisms. Chromatin architecture is controlled by DNA methylases and a whole range of enzymes or complexes that modify histones in various ways. There's about 60 of them known. What determines their site selectivity at the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of different sites around the genome is not known, but had been assumed to be transcription factors, a very vague term, but nevertheless. But it's looking increasingly like this is actually being controlled by RNAs, and it's RNAs that are providing the sequence-specific signals with the adaptive functions that then recruit generic protein complexes, their sites of action during differentiation development. And there's now good evidence from our lab and others that at least a subset of the long non-coding RNAs that differentially express during development fulfill this function, because they associate physically with complexes involved in chromatin modification. We've pinned the function to a few. I mean, as I said, there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of these long non-coding RNAs. Very few have been studied in detail. And in fact, I wrote a review for PLOS Genetics recently where I summarised the ones that had good functional data. And there's about 40. You know, it's a small, but it's enough to give you a flavour. So we and others have shown that one of these non-coding RNAs is required for the formation of paraspecles, which is a subnuclear compartment that's induced upon cellular differentiation. It's required for the formation of these things, and it's an integral structural component of them. Others have shown that, as I mentioned, that non-coding RNAs are associated with chromatin complexes. Others have been shown to be critically involved in biological assays for eye development, and many have been associated with different sorts of diseases. It's early days, and in fact, almost every time you go and functionally test a non-coding RNA which looks to be interesting because it's differentially expressed in one system or other, you get functional index data coming out. So it's, you know, there's this old idea that, you know, as complexity scaled, there'll be more and more genes, and there was speculation that humans might have 100,000 or more genes. As I said, it's a huge shock that's less, although people have just, you know, they haven't seemed to worry too much about that. But there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of these things. So this is where the real genetic scaling has occurred. It's perfectly possible. There's no doubt that with the genome-wide association studies looking into the genetic components of complex diseases and complex traits, that most of them mapped locations are non-coding and therefore almost by definition regulatory, and I don't think anybody... So it's really just a question of what form that regulatory variation takes. But there's an important point here, and that is that the early days of human gene mapping, which is not that long ago, even though it seems a long time ago, because so much has changed, but, you know, for cystic fibrosis and Huntington's and thalassemias, etc., these were what I call catastrophic component damage, where you lose a functional protein component, just like losing a light switch or, you know, a wheel. In most cases, it's pretty catastrophic. So the genetic signature is very strong. And it's also quite tractable to map because you can... Whereas complex diseases are often have multiple genetic components and they've been very difficult to map. It turns out that most of the catastrophic monogenic diseases, protein coding mutations, most of the genetic variation, not surprisingly, that affects complex human traits are regulatory mutations. And it's well over 90% of all of the genome-wide association studies, loci, mapped loci, are non-coding. And many of them are miles from anywhere. Now, all of these could be conventional cis-acting promoter or enhancer type mutations. But intriguingly, these things are falling into non-coding regions which are differentially expressing non-coding RNAs. And in fact, I think the differential expression of these RNAs is the only reliable genome-wide index of their function. And I'd like to make a particular point about the expression of non-coding RNAs. That is, it's extraordinarily precise. We did a study in conjunction with the Allen Brain Institute in Seattle where we looked at well over 1,000 of these non-coding RNAs in brain. And over half were expressed in brain and almost half showed extremely precise spatial expression. So we had Some that are only expressed in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus, others in particular layers of the cortex, others just in Purkinje cells in the cerebellum. And in 80% of the cases where we had sufficient resolution to tell, they were being trafficked to specific subcellular locations. So we're not talking about some sort of fuzzy random signal here, we're talking about extremely precise expression, both in terms of the cell specificity and also subcellular localization. And that, to me, has none of the signatures you'd expect of, you know, some sort of noisy background. One of my many favorite topics. Another set of facile assumptions about transposable elements have been made. And they, not by everybody, I might add, but it's widely assumed that transposon-derived sequences are simply selfish mobile genetic elements, selfish DNA. And books have been written about such things. Now, that's one possibility. But, you know, the raw material for evolution is duplication and transposition. So it's equally possible that a large fraction, who knows, but the whole lot will, a large fraction of the transposon-derived sequences that are in our genome are actually functional. I predict that there will be a very rapid change of attitude to transposon-derived sequences. We're already seeing papers showing their differential expression. Many of them are transcribed, by the way, by RNA polymerase 3, so they've been under the radar of poly-A-based approaches to the transcriptome. But I predict we're going to see that these things are critical drivers of evolution. They're critical players in embryogenesis and development, and that they're extremely critical players in the brain. I might just say one other thing about RNA that has really not penetrated the consciousness of most biologists yet, and that is that it's also extensively edited. And by editing I mean deamination of adenosines to form inosines or cytosines to form uracil, which changes the sequence and structure of the RNAs. RNA editing enzymes have expanded greatly during vertebrate, mammalian, and specifically primate evolution. They occur in most, if not all, tissues, but especially highly active in the brain. Some are brain-specific. And the amount of RNA editing in the human brain is approximately 30 times more intensive than that in the mouse brain. Now, without drawing all the dots together, it seems increasingly obvious that RNA editing is the principal means by which environmental information is transmitted to the epigenome. And so this actually connects environment to genome, the mechanism. And that also it was the elaboration of this system and its expansion was critically important to the evolution of the plasticity and the molecular mechanisms of learning and memory. In other words, RNA regulation is not only central to development, but the ability to plastically alter the RNA without changing the hardwired DNA, although that's an open question, it was critical to environmental plasticity in development in animals and to the evolution of cognition.